Welcome to episode 2 of Refuge Radio, a podcast about the National Wildlife Refuge Association and the issues facing more than 566 National Wildlife Refuges. This is Kristen Berry coming to you today from the offices of the National Wildlife Refuge Association in Washington, D.C. Joining me in Washington today to discuss urban refuges and the Urban Refuge Program is Joy Blackwood, Urban Refuge Program Director with the National Wildlife Refuge Association. And joining us from Southern California is Angie Horn. Angie's the SoCal Regional Refuge Partnership Specialist for the National Wildlife Refuge Association. Angie, thanks for speaking with us today.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
I know there are plenty of people with thoughts and questions about engaging with refuges and other wild places close to cities, as well as discussing how the environment impacts and helps to create communities. So please don't be shy with follow-up questions and comments. You can email us at info@refugeassociation.org, tweet us at Refuge Wild, or comment on our Facebook page at Refuge Association. Joy, if it's all right, I'd like to start with you. Can you explain what is an urban national wildlife refuge?
Sure. Alrighty. So an urban national wildlife refuge, if we're using the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's definition, it's a refuge that is within a population base of 250,000 people or more, that is about 25 miles or at least an hour's drive from any major metropolitan area. Within the within the refuge system itself, the 566 that you had mentioned in the intro, 101 have been identified as urban refuges, urban wildlife refuges. Of those 101, our program works strictly with 14. And the 14 have been designated by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's National Urban Wildlife Conservation Program. These 14 are spread throughout the United States. There are two refuges per region. And they are really and truly to serve as models due to their locale, the activities that they do with community. They are real staples and partners within their surrounding communities. And therefore, they're kind of stepping outside of the traditional box of what one would consider to be a refuge.
So, well, if that's the case, who stands to benefit from having an urban wildlife refuge nearby them?
All of us. just to get a very simple answer. But really and truly, it's all Americans. We all benefit from having these refuges in our areas, whether they are considered urban or in urban communities, suburbia, or whether they're rural. But we all benefit from our refuges.
Angie, I'd like to call you in on this one. You're on the ground in Southern California. What do you see, when you're out at a refuge, or what do you hear, even when you're just walking around your own neighborhood, about the impact of these urban refuges?
Sure. As you may know, Southern California is very highly populated. And people love the outdoors. They love their national parks, their state parks. And the wildlife refuge system here, at least in San Diego, has been hugely impactful. It's right on the bay. It essentially functions as an urban park. In fact, when you're in San Diego, it's almost indistinguishable because there's so many protected lands around the same area that people can move from a state park into a refuge on a bikeway, into the bay, into a state beach, and not even realize that they're kind of moving through things. So, people value them. And I think what the goal is here is to make sure people know that they're on a refuge. So they know, why it's important and why they should advocate for it. I think, awareness is a big part of what we do here in SoCal, because I don't think that whether it's state parks or local parks or the refuge system, there's a lot of good signage and information out there. So people love the outdoors. It's just a matter of letting them know that where they are at any given time, that's important. So they have the vocabulary to advocate for these places when they are, under some kind of threat.
That's a great segue. So there's a campaign that the Refuge Association is undertaking right now to raise the awareness of 14 of these urban national wildlife refuges. Can you tell me a little bit about the issues that you're trying to tackle and describe the campaign, if you will?
Sure. So, granted, we are focused on 14 because that's our working 14. However, we're raising awareness of all 101. So the ultimate goal of our campaign is really and truly to, just like Angie said, there are so many people out here that are recreating on our refuges. We're driving over Bayou Sauvage's refuge as you head up to Lacombe, Louisiana. Folks don't know that that's what they're doing. We walk, we recreate, we ride our bikes, the whole nine, and nine times out of ten, people do not know they're actually on refuge land. And so our campaign is really to bring that awareness. It's to share with folks why these beautiful swaths of land are in their neighborhoods, the purpose for them, and then also just to let them know that, you know, they do benefit. They benefit us all. They help our hearts, our minds, our spirits. I mean, that's sort of like a kumbaya kind of moment when you're just kind of standing there on refuge land quietly. And if you don't know where you are, you can't fully appreciate and advocate for it. And so our campaign is to kind of excite you to do so.
So you mentioned that you can recreate on refuges. What are some of the things that you can do on a wildlife refuge?
Well,
why would anybody want to go there?
Good question, right? So there's, of course, what a Fish and Wildlife Service's terminology, which does not flow well off my tongue, which is wildlife-dependent recreation, and that's the big six. And I have to be honest, if I'm going to rattle off the big six, I'm going to stumble along the way. So, Angie, please chime in if I miss something.
But... And for anybody who's listening, don't worry. We'll have links in the show notes to documents that will highlight what the big six are.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. But, of course, the big one right now, just given the secretarial orders and the big push with the sporting community, there's hunting, there is fishing, we have photography, we have interpretation, observation, wildlife observations, and then what is it, hiking, walking. I actually like to say walking, not hiking. And what am I missing? That's one that's missing there. I said photography, interpretation, environmental education, one of our most important ones.
Sure.
Given that many of our refugees work with our next generation and are basically gearing up to prepare our workforce that's kind of aging out.
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned the environmental education piece of this. I've had the good pleasure of visiting several of these designated urban wildlife refuges, and I've been struck by something that seems to be a consistent theme across them all, which is their engagement with school kids. And when I was in Texas and visiting the Santa Ana National Wildlife Refuge, I was amazed to find out that the refuge was kind of this little garden, secret garden almost, that the schools were using, not only for a place to go, but a place to come back from and do their own pollinator gardens or their own wild spaces where they are. Can you cite examples or unpack a little bit for us just the impact on school kids that you've seen and how that environmental education doesn't only take place on the refuge, but elsewhere.
Exactly. So within the urban program itself, one of the things that we have been trying to do, especially within the National Urban Wildlife Conservation Program, is that not all people are going to feel comfortable coming to refuge because they don't know where they're coming. So therefore, we are meeting community where they are, and we're bringing the refuge to them. That's the schoolyard habitats. or mini refuges that you actually witnessed when you were in South Texas. That's one of our partnerships that we're doing. We're working with the South Texas Refuge Complex in really bringing the classroom outdoors, and it's by using these schoolyard habitats, pollinator gardens, mini refuges. The same thing is happening in Southern California. A lot of the work that Angie's doing, and I'll let her speak for it, but a lot of the work that she's doing, especially within the greater Los Angeles region, are off refuge because there is not a refuge right there, or the closest refuge is not open to non-U.S. citizens. It's Seal Beach, and so we're able to actually bring refuge to community. And
how about it, Angie? Can you tell us a little bit about how people in Southern California, kids in particular, are getting their environmental education fix on the refuge, but also off it?
Sure. So I mentioned San Diego earlier, which also happens to be the most accessible in the region. And the SoCal Urban Wildlife Refuge Project is administered out of that complex. But the vast majority of the population of Southern California lives in the Los Angeles area. And we do have a few of those schoolyard habitats where there is environmental education. We're hoping to have a third come up at an elementary school. But those are just sort of, you know, those are in central Los Angeles, and we need a large suite and array of partners with a lot of capacity to do this. And so there are about 11 or 12 nonprofit partners that have been engaged all over the region around environmental education to reach into these communities because they cannot come out to these refuges, like Joy said. I'm going to go north to south here. In the north, in Ventura County, there are actually two wildlife refuges, but they're closed to the public because of the California Condor Recovery Program. And, you know, that's a hugely important conservation effort that's been going on for decades. And there are people living at the base of these refuges who have no idea the refuge is there and no idea that they live, like, 2 miles from, you know, the California condor habitat. And so there's the Condor Kids Program, which actually has created an entire curriculum that teachers can bring into their classrooms. And, you know, there's a component where they can go do field visits, but that curriculum is really, really important to bring those principles into the classrooms. And that's administered in partnership with the Santa Barbara Zoo. Zoos are very important to our project. In San Diego, they do have a lot of nonprofit partners who actually bring children on to the refuge. There's actually the Living Coast Discovery Center is located in the main part of the San Diego Refuge, and it's a museum and discovery center, and they do a lot of programming. There are organizations like Ocean Connectors, which you know, they bring kids to the shore and teach them about the ecology there, the outdoor outreach. And we have the Audubon groups. And in Los Angeles, the two big partners we have who reach into most of the community, actually, between the two of them, is the Los Angeles Conservation Corps and the Friends of the L.A. River. And the L.A. Conservation Corps is really about workforce development, getting out there and actually cleaning up the river, doing, you know, really important conservation projects, tree plantings, and giving kids the skills and hopefully boosting their interest in sort of outdoors careers and priming them to be stewards of the environment. So even though they're off refuge, those principles they're still very much present in their work. And the Friends of the LA River is really dedicated to improving the LA River from recreation to cycling. They use environmental education. And the biggest program that we support there is the River Rover, which is a mobile museum that literally brings the river to these communities that can't really access it. So there's a lot of tools in the toolbox that we use, and these nonprofit partners are hugely important to delivering the message.
Sounds like you got a lot going on. Joy, go ahead.
Yeah, so just to add on to our beautiful array of examples and partnerships that we have, author R. Marshall Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge. Also one of our...
Say that three times.
I know, right? It took me a minute. That's why you heard the bang of the pen for a hot second. But their partnership, not only are they working within their surrounding community, within Boynton Beach, Palm Beach County, but they're also now extending their reach with into Miami and working now with Children's Hospital. And they're building a mini refuge. And although the kids at the hospital can actually participate and help with, you know, the digging of the dirt, the planting of the native plants, they can actually go out and enjoy and recreate and see those beautiful butterflies.
Yeah, healing through nature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's a lot of activity happening within our various school groups, both on and off refuge, that really adds that environmental education component.
Well, it sounds like you're having a great deal of impact out there. The team that's involved with this has to be more than just you and Angie. Who's all contributing here?
Absolutely. So within the staff team for the Refuge Association's Urban Refuge Program, yes, it's Angie and I. However, for this campaign, we have joined forces with the staff within our communications department. And so, Kristen.
Hey, I'm on the team.
There you go. Thank you very much for being one of the fearless leaders.
Happy to be
thinkers,
here.
Behind this initial vision that we had almost 2 years ago. And then there's also Eden Taylor, who is the associate within the communications team. We have a summer intern, Hannah Phelps, yep. I believe is how we pronounce her last name. And then, of course, Bhargavi, and I'm so sorry, Bhargavi, I'm going to actually ask you to pronounce your full name, but Bhargavi is our very first Urban Refuge Program intern from the Standback Duke University internship program. So please introduce yourself.
Hi, yes, I was going to pretend I wasn't here and be fly on the wall, but now I had a talk. But I'm Bhargavi Karmuri, and like Joy said, I'm getting my master's at Duke right now, and I'm here through the Standback program. So, yeah.
Well, Bhargavi, thank you for being on the podcast today. I'm sorry I didn't introduce you at the beginning.
Yeah, but it takes all, so it definitely is. While we are small, we are strappy, but we're definitely dividing and conquering and hopefully inspiring the hearts and minds of those that are going to be watching and following and engaging with us, because that's what we want.
Well, so just a couple more questions. How will you and your team know that you've succeeded? Is there a benchmark that's a year down the road, 5 years down the road? Is it something that we'll see and feel every day? What does success look like?
Wow. So personally, if I've got my wish list, success is every American right now, when I walk or encounter, or if any of us encounter them, they talk refuge and they say refuge, or they're out there, you know, advocating for the National Wildlife Refuge System. That's my wish list.
That's a beautiful vision. That's a real vision.
Right. But if we're talking immediate success or progress of just really shifting the needle, one way is to increase our followers. You know, we're stepping into the social media digital space. It's not a place that I had started out with. I was still writing blogs and, you know, doing the paper thing, right? Doing a beautiful flyer here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
But we're stepping in this space. So if we start getting a good following after this second leg of our campaign, that will show me that we're shifting the needle and we're really making progress.
That's great. So, Angie, being our person on the ground, kind of posting off of that question a little bit, talk to us a little bit how listeners can support the campaign, how they can take action in their neighborhoods, and then connect with us on the national level.
Sure. Well, they can spread the word, for sure. I mean, this is, I do want to point out that this is a kind of a social media campaign. You know, it's very much an online space. And So if they're interested, they can, you know, spread it to their networks. I'd really like it if people shared their experiences on the refuge. I think the best way that we can reach more people is by taking those who are already engaged and making them ambassadors, especially in the online space, because it's all about critical mass, you know, getting those hashtags out there and really centering refuge sort of in that consciousness. You know, and if you love refuges, you already know what they are, you know, bring people to them. If family and friends are visiting from out of town, you know, take them out for a walk or something like that. You know, send the Refuge Association money. send donations. Yeah, just boost.
Jump on a future episode of the podcast.
And volunteer.
I know that's a really inelegant way of pitching that. But, you know, there are so many different ways. However you want to engage, whatever you're comfortable with, you know, do it, but get it out there in whatever way you feel comfortable. And, you know, I really think refuge issues, this is a good time to center them because people are aware of what's happening in Alaska, but they don't really have the vocabulary to describe what their feelings are about it, because I think they kind of know what's happening, but they're just not familiar enough with it. And I think what's happening there could you know, people need to make the connection between the refuges in their backyard and the ones that are happening in these areas like Alaska. And they're all part of the same sort of unit. So I kind of want to make people aware of this huge system that's out there. And they're all connected. And it's important to boost the signal. And it'll positively affect all of these refuges.
Well, Anjay, I want you to know that I did my part today. Today is not only the longest day of the year, but it's also International Selfie Day. And so I posted my selfie from a refuge today, one of my favorite pictures of myself, the Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge in Washington State.
Oh, geez, I need to post my picture of Bear River on the airboat.
There you go.
that was a thrill.
Yeah. All right, well, I want to say thank you very much for taking the time to talk about the program and talk about how people can engage. I think listeners will find this an interesting subject, and I hope that we can do another episode down the road as we start to talk about the specific refuges that you're highlighting. Is there anything I haven't asked you that you wish I would before we get off the air?
Well, the one thing that I would like to share, given that our campaign, this second leg of the campaign, is really a human interest experience. We really and truly want people's perspectives, and we want them to share their stories. Now, granted, we're going to be really good at doing good storytelling, but nobody can tell your story better than you. Mm-hmm. So I just once again just ask the audience, please engage. This is a great opportunity for all of us to share our stories of how nature, what nature means to us, how we're connecting, how we're engaging with it. You know, just share.
That's a great segue to go out on, because you've got an opportunity to share your story with us here at Refuge Radio by tweeting at us or signing on to our Facebook page, sending us an email, and for sure listening to the next podcast. So,
absolutely.
Angie Horn, thank you very much. Joy Blackwood, thank you very much. Bhargavi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This has been really exciting, and I'm very excited about the next few months going forward.
We are too. We'll see you on the next episode of Refuge Radio.